Thank you very much. No, Dr. Dalton took one of the quotes I was going to use, which it makes it a perfect segue into the fact that we're going to talk today a little bit about a complete breeding sanitized exam, which is going to be distinguished from just a semen check or a semen exam, because we're going to take into account the whole health status of the animal. Now, as my colleagues can tell you, on both BSCs or breeding sanitized exams and venereal disease in livestock, I could talk for hours. And so I'm going to only hit some of the highlights this afternoon, but certainly over a beer tonight we can talk at more depth about some of this, because it's quite a fascinating area. And so the standards that we're going to follow are set forth by the Society of Theriogenology. So that is an organization of veterinarians that are dedicated to animal reproduction and healthy animals and the best animals breeding. And so they serve all species, but it actually their origins go back to bulls and the fact that this is sort of the origins of the society. This is scrotal frostbite on the bottom of two bulls. And it was the blizzard in 1949 through Colorado that actually damaged quite a few bulls because of scrotal frostbite that led to an organization to start to predict or interpret the potential breeding soundness of a bull, which later then evolved into this society. And they're the standards that most veterinarians will follow in terms of evaluating a bull for breeding soundness. And so everything that we talk about will go back to scrotal frostbite, if you will. And so like we talked about, it's more than just a semen check, because really, if you're going to have a potential breeder, you need to have an animal that's both going to be producing normal spermatozoa at normal concentrations, and that's going to be able to actually get that sperm into a cow successfully. And so we'll take a first look at the general conformation and physical condition, adequate body condition score of the animal, and look at their conformation. And now, while we can't truly fail them in a breeding sanitized exam in terms of conformation, we can make some recommendations to the producer. We can also try to highlight some potentially genetic-based abnormalities, such as corkscrew claw, as you can see here. We're going to certainly make sure their head has no signs of severe pneumonia, no active pink eye, or previous lesions on their eyes that might render them blind and otherwise incapacitated. And then we'll move into a more reproductively oriented physical exam. We're going to evaluate the internal accessory sex glands that help contribute the volume to the semen, as well as some buffers, the penis and prepuce, and of course the scrotal contents, so testicles, epididymi, and the overall shape of the scrotum. And this is going to be happening relatively quickly, so we're not going to be taking a lot of time to do this by watching the animal walk up to the squeeze chute, doing a couple of base parameters and letting them go. We can actually get quite a good assessment in a relatively short period of time. And of course, we need to have adequate restraint facilities. I don't like to be trying to collect semen from an animal that's either not properly restrained or tied to a fence post somewhere. It's not going to be good for anybody. So one thing, libido and mating ability is going to be key. And there have been a couple different scoring systems that have been proposed over the years, but none of them have been very well accepted by the industry. And so while we can try to look at statistically how many cows they mate or mount, it's really no substitute to actually putting them out with a cow in estrus and watching to see if they can mount and breed. It's going to take into account a lot of factors, isn't it? The general health and nutrition, like we'd already talked about, their visual capacity, their overall conformation, making sure they're not lame, any congenital considerations. And then we like to talk about functional male infertility, where if we have unsecure footing in snowy, icy areas, if we're having bulls slip as they try to be mounted, or out on range, if we have such a large plot of land or ranch where we have a relatively small number of bulls for a relatively large number of cows, they might be the best bulls in the world, but they're not going to be able to find those cows and get them pregnant in an efficient manner. So the first thing that we're going to focus on once they're already in the squeeze chute is going to be scrotal circumference and palpation of those scrotal contents. And this can tell us quite a bit. We're going to use this scrotal circumference as an indirect indicator of testicular volume and therefore as an indicator of daily sperm output, or how many sperm can be produced on a daily basis. It's highly correlated with the weight of each testes when you measure it in grams. So we can do this. We have minimum standards set forth by the Society of Theriogenology, and of course, this is a generalization across all beef breeds, that by the time they've gone through puberty and they're up to 15 months, we want to see a minimum scrotal circumference of 30 centimeters. And by the time they're 2 years old, we want to see them at least 34 centimeters. Now, we know there are differences that exist from breed to breed. And so this is a generalization, of course. We know some breeds, especially Bos Indicus cattle, some Texas Longhorns, even Limousines, tend to have smaller scrotal circumferences as compared to standard Bos Taurus cattle. And so there is a push to make some more breed-specific recommendations. When you're working with your veterinarian with your own breed, you'll actually be able to look through some more of the literature and look to what the average scrotal circumferences are for that breed, and that might be a more applicable standard to stick to. This also lets us make sure there are no adhesions, no wounds or abscesses that we need to worry about that might interfere with the temperature control of the testes and therefore production and maturation of the sperm. We'll then do a very quick rectal exam. So the internal organs of the bull are just as important as the testes themselves. So here we'll have the testes and epididymi. They're going to be hanging in a very pendulous scrotum. The sperm will go up the vas deferens, go through. We have the ampullae. And meet up with the urethra, where we have seminal vesicles and a prostate all coming together, right where the urinary bladder is going to enter that pelvic urethra as well. Then it tends to come up through the calpers, or the bulbo urethral glands, and then out through the long fibroelastic penis and ejaculated. So we have a lot of areas where we can have problems or potential problems. When we're rectally palpating them, we only have to be about wrist deep, and we'll be actually feeling all but the bulbo urethral glands here on rectal palpation, just to make sure that we don't have any inflamed organs. The most common thing that we tend to see is a seminal vesiculitis, or inflammation of these seminal vesicles, but in general terms, it's quite a rare condition that we actually see. Okay, we'll set up our lab pretty much anywhere, ideally out of the wind and out of the sun and out of the cold. So maybe not anywhere, but sometimes we'll do it in the lab at the clinic. Other times we'll set up in a trailer or around the corner from the squeeze chute. And very minimal equipment, we can actually do a very complete, thorough breeding soundness evaluation. Of course, we're going to need to have our scrotal measuring tape, a way to collect the semen, ideally a phase contrast microscope. We're going to keep everything as warm as possible. Remember, temperature and time are your biggest enemies when you're trying to do a field semen evaluation. And then, as Dr. Dalton was talking about, contrast stains, because in addition to motility, morphology is going to be a huge contributing factor to our breeding soundness evaluation. So we have basically two ways to actually collect semen, right? We can use an artificial vagina, which is going to give us a very representative sample, and may allow us to assess the libido of the bull. But this is typically reserved for AI studs or bulls that are trained to the AV. The vast majority of our herd bulls for range breeding, we're going to be using an electroejaculator. Okay, so this is a rectal probe that's actually going to go and emit a very low-power sine wave of energy that's going to stimulate the pelvic urethral muscles as well as the prostate and seminal vesicular glands to contract, allow an erection, and allow an ejaculation. There have been some studies recently looking at whether this is causing severe discomfort or pain to the animal, and there's conflicting studies, but many of the recent ones acknowledge that there's probably some temporary discomfort, but by measuring some neuropeptides and cortisol levels, they don't believe that it's a painful experience. It was, of course, initially developed for humans under general anesthesia or paraplegics, and we'll use it for rams and even cats. That's an experience, I can tell you. But so it has a very good application across species when used appropriately. Okay, so we'll enter the probe rectally, of course, with good restraint. We'll have an increasing intensity and pulsation, or kind of a rhythmic contraction, and we'll eventually get extension of the penis, ejaculation, and we'll collect it into ideally a warm cone or tube. And we're going to collect the sperm opaque rich fraction of the ejaculate and immediately analyze it. Okay. This extension and erection gives us a great opportunity to look for some penile abnormalities or preputial problems that might prevent the bull from breeding. Because remember, no matter how good his semen is, if he can't actually penetrate the cow and breed her, he's not going to be a good potential breeder. So things like persistent frenulums, which are known to have a heritable component, we're starting to see more and more in Angus and pulled Hereford cattle. Just failure of the tip of the penis to detach from the base of the penis. This is a very normal finding soon after birth. And then as they go through puberty, this breaks down and they have a free end of the penis. We might see penile warts, which is caused by a papillomavirus in cattle. And a young bull will remove one or two warts, and it shouldn't be an issue anymore. If we're having these very severe cases of warts, we might be worried about the immune status of that bull and whether it's truly competent or not. And if we see these all of a sudden pop up in an older bull that's never had a problem before, we do have some malignant cancers that can look very similar to common benign warts we'll want to take into account. Corkscrew penis or a rainbow or ventral deviation of the penis where we have problems with the ligament that runs along the top aspect of that penis, whether it slips off and corkscrews and too early before intromission or whether it cannot be maintained as a straight penis before intromission. Of course, those are not going to be good for breeding the cow, and so we're going to want to know that. Sometimes the only way to know truly is to watch that bull try to breed a cow and see it. And then other relatively benign problems, herrings or feces and dirt being up in the prep use, we can identify the time of a breeding sanus exam. Okay. So once we have our sperm sample, we're going to actually look at the motility, of course. We're going to look at our gross and individual motility. So the gross semen is just going to be a drop of raw semen on a warm slide at low magnification. It's going to be a function of motility and concentration in the bull. We'll then go ahead and do individual motility, and I apologize for how a little bit choppy there. We'll dilute it out with some sodium citrate, a very isotonic solution, and we'll look to see what percentage of sperm has forward progressive motility, not just being buffeted around by the other active sperm. And we're going to take both of these into account when we're looking at our motility measurement. We can certainly just do this by an estimation of the eye, which is what most of us are going to do in the field. If you're at an AI collection facility or a laboratory facility or a higher-end clinic that might have computer-aided semen analysis, you might use that. It's called a CASA. So we have minimum standards, of course, set forth by the society for motility. And so the absolute minimum we want to see is a 30% minimum forward progressive motility. And, of course, this sounds very low. Ideally, we're going to have them well above 60 to 70% individual progressive motility. But we have a low number to account for often subpar field conditions that we're collecting semen in. And certainly, like we talk about here, if we're debating whether or not it's 30% or not, we either need to get another sample or defer the bull and recheck him. I'll tell you that we don't routinely measure concentration in these ejaculates. We're looking for a couple parameters that can give us some information on the potential fertility of this bull. Now, if we were collecting this to free semen, of course, it'd be a good concentration determined for accurate calculation and dilution into semen straws. But we don't typically measure them on a routine basis. We'll use that scrotal circumference as our indirect indicator, won't we? And then the morphology. So scrotal circumference and palpation, individual progressive motility, and normal morphology are going to be our three main components of a breeding sanus examination. And this, I think, gets overlooked occasionally, and it's probably the most important, even more so than motility, in terms of the potential breeding of this bull. We're going to make a stain, which will kill the sperm, and then we'll look at it under high power magnification. And what this is going to tell us is if there's any abnormality with the normal subarchitecture of that sperm. Okay, we're going to have the head, of course, where all the DNA and chromatin is contained. The acrosomal cap is where there's some enzymes that are going to allow penetration into the oocyte at the time of fertilization. We'll have our midpiece that has lots of mitochondria that create energy and help the sperm move. And then we'll have the rest of the tail. And by looking at morphologic abnormalities, we can divide them up and, to some extent, localize them within the testes or different regions of the epididymis as development, maturation, and final ejaculation occur. So we mentioned some different classification schemes. There have been multiple that have been proposed over the years, and none of them are perfect, unfortunately. We tend to classify sperm into primary and secondary classifications, which simply tells the location of the defect's origin. So primary abnormalities, as a rule, are going to be testicular in origin. Secondary abnormalities are going to be maturational, so in the epididymis or beyond. They might even be the result of improper semen handling after ejaculation. As was alluded to earlier, compensatory and non-compensatory defects probably tell us a lot more based on what's going to happen as a result of that defect. So a couple examples here of some of the defects that we're going to look for. If we look at primary abnormalities, we can see some head-shaped problems. So this is what we call a knobbed acrosome. So that little cap that has those enzymes that are responsible for actually penetrating the oocyte at fertilization, we're going to have a problem there. And this is actually a known heritable defect that we'll look for, either a knobbed or a ruffled acrosome. We'll see other head-shaped abnormalities, which are often an indicator of the structure of the chromatin or the DNA within that head. We're going to be certainly worried about those in terms of being a very good fertilizable sperm. And then we'll see other head shapes, some tail problems, and mid-piece abnormalities. This DAG defect is from Mr. Dag. He was a Jersey bull that this was identified in. Actually seemed to be quite a self-limiting trait when it was identified. But we'll see other DAG-like defects where we have abnormal build of that mid-piece, which can lead to motility and fertilization issues. We'll also see some secondary problems. Remember, these are going to be more maturational or from the time of leaving the epididymis to the time of being out in the atmosphere. And so by looking and identifying and recognizing the most common ones, we can actually try to isolate the problem and try to find out why the bull is having the morphologic abnormalities that he is, or if there are greater implications for breeding this bull. And so in the end, we're going to have three classifications that we typically use. A satisfactory potential breeder, meaning they meet the minimum standards for all of our parameters, and they have a satisfactory physical exam. A deferred status will be for a bull that has a temporary condition that we don't exactly know what's going on. We just know he's not meeting our minimum standards right now. And then we'll have an unsatisfactory potential breeder where they fail and we're not going to recheck him, or they have an irreversible damage to one part of his reproductive system or the sperm. And this is a standard form we use to report out all these abnormalities so we have a consistent basis for it. Okay. So that's an overview just of the veterinary breeding status exam. And I just want to talk for a few minutes about some venereal disease that we'll see in bulls. And there are numerous agents, viral, bacterial, and fungal, that can cause infertility or be transmitted at the time of breeding. But there are going to be two that are going to be the biggest ones. Of course, Trichomonas fetus, or Trich, is going to be a large one. And then I'm going to talk just briefly about Campylobacter, or Vibrio, afterwards. And they really are nice to talk about together because they have a very similar epidemiology, and they behave, to some extent, very similarly. So I'm sure most people have heard about Trich, certainly caused by a single protozoa that tends to reside on the bull's penis and within the folds of the bull's prepuce. And this is just looking at it under low-power magnification, as it looks like a sort of falling leaf when it's going across, sort of a gyrating movement, very characteristic of this protozoa. And so certainly it is transmitted from the bull, who doesn't have any clinical signs, typically, to the cow during breeding. And, of course, the female is going to be the recipient of a whole host of problems. And so it's everywhere in the country. This map doesn't say or indicate the prevalence of Trich, more the states that have imposed their own regulations on importing bulls and, to some extent, cows into their state. Many states, especially in the western half of the country, are very concerned with the control of Trichomonas fetus right now. It's a devastating economic disease, and so we've set up a lot of checkpoints to try and limit our exposure to our cattle industry. And Dr. Bondurant here in 1989 did a study long before Trich was reportable, and he found that about 16% of cow-calf herds in the state were infected with Trich, which equated to approximately 5% of all bulls tested. Now, we're in the process of trying to determine the current prevalence in 2014-2015, but it's actually been somewhat difficult. I can tell you that in 2013, of all the samples submitted to the state diagnostic lab, only about 1% came back positive. So we like to think that we are doing a good job at reducing the incidence, but it's hard to say. And the reason that we put so much emphasis on regulations and testing and culling is because there is no legal effective treatment in the United States for Trichorhinomonas foetus. And so we really are left with a test and cull policy. So what does it actually do? I said it lives on the bull's penis and prepuce, transmitted at the time of breeding. And what it's going to do is basically cause a transient infection of the vagina, cervix, and uterus of the cow. Interestingly, fertilization and conception still occur. So we're still going to have binding of the sperm and the oocyte. We're still going to have the migration through the oviduct and into the uterine horn. But then, early on in pregnancy, many times even before the cow can recognize or have maternal recognition of pregnancy that she's pregnant, we're going to have a huge inflammatory response to this foreign organism in the uterus. And that inflammation is going to lead to that conceptus dying. There are other trichomonads that we need to worry about, tetra and pentatrichomonads, which instead of having the three flagella, hence Trichorhinomonas foetus, they'll have four and five flagella. And, of course, you cannot distinguish this under a light microscope, and we rely on DNA testing to try and distinguish the two. And they're often contaminated in this area because we'll call them, quote-unquote, fecal tricks, or just normal fecal contamination, but they don't cause the same type of disease that the Trichorhinomonas does. And that's going to play into our ability to detect this disease in just a second. So it's extremely efficient in its transmission. After one breeding, if you have an infected bull, there's a 70% chance that he's going to transmit that to a susceptible cow. Like I said, our outcomes are typically embryonic death, so less than 42 to 45 days of gestation. So in the first month and a half after conception is when we're really going to be concerned. We might have abortions that occur later on in pregnancy. They do happen, but they're much more rare. So we'll have this fetal loss, and you can see within this amniotic vesicle all the white blood cells and all the inflammation going on. Of course, no fetus or conceptus will be able to survive in that. Right? Many times we'll actually find, when we go to preg check on beef cattle, a postcoital pyometra. So we'll actually find a pyometra or a uterus full of pus that we can palpate at the time of preg check. And that's a very classic sign of trich, even though it only happens in about 5% of infected cows. The cow will clear the infection eventually on her own, and she'll develop a very short-lived immunity, so she could get rebred to that same infected bull, conceive, and carry a calf to term in that same breeding season if the breeding season is long enough. Unfortunately, that immunity will not carry over to the following breeding season. Okay? So when we're trying to control or eliminate this from a herd or prevent it from coming in the first place, we will get a smegma scraping from the inside of the bull's prepuce, which they love, if you've seen it happening. And so ideally we'll take a dry infusion pipette and try to get a good amount of smegma from the inside. We'll transport them typically in these in-pouch. They're just it's a proprietary media that's optimized to allow trich to survive and replicate if present. And the funny thing with this is it's a very fastidious little organism, considering how much damage it can do to a herd. We have a very narrow temperature range that we like to sample and ship them in. And so you'll see your veterinarian hopefully being somewhat particular about the time of year and even day of the week that we sample them on to get them to the lab at the appropriate time. Once they're there, we have culture and PCRs, or where we can detect the DNA specific to the Trichorhinomonas foetus. If we culture them, we're going to incubate them and check them every day for motility. If we have a positive, we can't, like I said, differentiate that from the non-pathogenic, the non-disease causing trichs. And so we'll instantly run a backup to make sure that DNA is specific for the venereal form. But many of us now are going to running a one-time PCR, where we'll incubate that sample for 24 hours and then specifically look for that DNA segment. And many states are accepting a one-time PCR test as a negative bull for interstate transport. Okay. Like I said, many times we'll see it just as on a herd level. We'll be suspicious of a problem if we're palpating a lot of pyometras at the time of pregnancy diagnosis, or if we're having a very delayed breed up during the breeding season. Remember, ideally we'll have most of our cows get bred at the very first cycle, ideally at least 60%, And then have subsequent following on the following cycles. But many times we'll see either a very low pregnancy rate or a very delayed breed up in the herd, and that can be one thing to pop to the top of your head. Okay, preventing it and controlling it, we're going to try and avoid commingling with other cattle of unknown status. And a lot of grazing associations have started requiring Trichomonas testing before the breeding season. If you can use AI, that eliminates the bull reservoir. And using a very narrow breeding season and culling open cows after that is going to be a great way to eliminate them too. Of course, managing your bulls, buy virgin bulls or use your own replacements, and always test before mixing them in with your bull battery. And there is a vaccination on the market. This should not be relied upon as a sole effort. And I really don't recommend it unless you have trick or are dealing with trick in the surrounding area. But in the face of an endemic herd or a positive bull or a neighbor with a positive bull, vaccinating the cows can reduce the incidence of abortion or embryo loss because of the disease. It's not currently labeled in bulls, but there is some preliminary data that suggests that maybe it has an effect on the immunity of the prep use, but more studies are needed for that right now. So the biggest headache, honestly, with trick are the regulatory issues. Like I said, many states have trick regulations, but each state sets their own requirements. There's a national effort to harmonize these standards and make them more compliant from state to state to state for ease of ranchers and veterinarians and the bull, I suppose. But that hasn't happened yet. But I expect in the next couple of years we will have some progress there. California, interestingly, we were one of the first to put regulations in place in 2003. Now we seem to have the most liberal testing requirements of any state in the country. Right now, anytime we sell a bull through auction that's over 18 years of old, or we bring a bull into state, they must be accompanied by a negative Trichomonas test. And then there's new talk about the possible carrier cow. The rare cow that might actually harbor an infection to the next breeding cycle and serve as a source in the herd. And it's become so much of a concern that some states, like Nebraska and Kansas, have actually limited the importation of open cows into the state because they worry this might be a source or a potential source of trick. So I expect that to be a hot topic over the next couple of years. Similarly, Campylobacter, or Vibrio as it's commonly known, is a bacterial infection that, again, lives on the surface of the penis and prepuce, transmitted at breeding, and will cause very similar signs as Trichomonas fetus. This, however, once the cow clears the infection, she'll have a much longer-lasting immunity to that disease as opposed to trich. And so when we see herd-level data looking at pregnancy rates, we can have a very sporadic preg rate over a couple years. And the having no pattern fits into the pattern of Campylobacter. I just want to mention that, interestingly, vaccination is both a treatment and a control of Campylobacter. I recommend that every beef cow and bull be vaccinated for Campylobacter as a rule. We do have some reported treatments other than that, but by rule, using them with one of the oil-based adjuvant vaccines has been shown to be curative in young bulls less than 4 years old. And then, of course, annual boosting of that vaccination. I just bring this up both to represent every drug company, hopefully, that's here, and to show that there are a lot of products that contain Vibrio or Campylobacter as a component to a multivalent vaccine, usually indicated by a V somewhere in the title. And then, of course, you can read Campylobacter in the components. One place we get into problems with is when we see an accidental shift from one containing Vibrio to one not containing Vibrio, because sometimes labeling can be very similar. So I encourage you to make sure you know what product you're using, and of course to always incorporate this into a cow-calf vaccination protocol. And so with that, I'll take any questions if there's time, or certainly talk later